Chapter 2. Love is Society. Love, noun. A temporary insanity, curable by marriage or by removal of the patient from the influences under which he incurred the disorder. This disease, like caries and many other ailments, is prevalent only among civilized races living under artificial conditions. Barbarous nations, breathing pure air and eating simple food, enjoy immunity from its ravages. It is sometimes fatal, but more frequently to the physician than to the patient. Ambrose Bierce, The Devil's Dictionary. Let's just talk. Not even an introvert like me exists in a social vacuum. The society around us constantly shapes and influences everything we think, say, and do. This influence often goes unnoticed. It tends to make its presence felt only when we start resisting it in some way. But noticed or not, it is real, and its effects are powerful. In many ways, we are artifacts of culture. When I talk publicly about having two partners, people often react by trying to reinforce the cultural norm of monogamy that I've broken. Some call me horrible names in anonymous comments or messages, attempting to shore up that norm. Others remind me that I'm not normal in subtler ways, unprompted declarations that they could never do that, for example, or reminders that my life is an experiment, as if anyone's isn't. But I want to talk about the power of the unsubtle for a moment. Let's think about the word slut. The meaning of the word slut encodes a socially significant idea that promiscuous women are bad. The word packs together a description, promiscuous woman, and an evaluation, bad. This means that when you use this word uncritically, you commit yourself to that value judgment. That is, you signal to the world that you think promiscuous women are bad. Of course, the meanings of words can change, and some pejoratives and slurs get reclaimed over time, losing their negative connotations. But slut retains much of its negative charge, despite some efforts at reclamation. I mention this because language is a great case study in how our mechanisms for transmitting socially significant information are simultaneously effective and invisible. When we learn a language as children, we do not critically assess each new word, think through all the consequences of using it, and decide whether or not we approve of those consequences. We just imitate the people around us. We just talk. But learning the word slut at an early age will influence our perception of women for the rest of our lives. As any advertiser will tell you, a name can change everything. A rose by the name Poo Petals would not smell as sweet. But most people never notice how the language they speak prescribes their worldview. Slurs are among the more obvious examples of how language shapes our understanding, but all sorts of language can be used to encode social information, transmitting and reinforcing cultural values. Indeed, the very fact that we even have a word for something provides an implicit signal that it is worth talking about. The effects of lacking words to describe one's own experiences can be serious. For example, lacking a word like polyamorous, a polyamorous person can be left reaching for words that encode a negative judgment, such as unfaithful, or suggest a crime or sin, such as adulterous. Only being able to describe your intimate feelings by passing negative judgment on yourself has psychological consequences. The worldviews encoded in our language are handed to us through the social mechanism of language learning. So what we get depends on the particular social context we happen to find ourselves in when we are acquiring language. It's a bit of a lottery. What have we created? Language is just one of a suite of powerful tools that societies use to transmit information and reinforce values. We are also permanently imbibing the art, politics, institutions, laws, practices, and traditions of the culture within which we are embedded. We have been taking all this in by osmosis since our earliest childhood, and it's now practically impossible to think outside all of these boxes, even if we try. They are such a normal and continuous part of life that they seem completely natural to us. It's no coincidence that we use this word, natural, to describe the utterly familiar. Familiarity makes it so easy to mistake culture for nature. Romantic love is a perfect example of how society shapes our sense of what is natural. In this chapter, I discuss the theory that romantic love is a social construct, something society has created rather than a feature of biology. I look at reasons for denying that romantic love is a human universal, at least in any straightforward way. Despite what the biological theory of love would have us believe, there are good reasons for treating romantic love as a relatively recent, localized phenomenon, one that varies significantly among cultures because they construct it differently. To think our way into these ideas, let's consider ancient Greece for a moment. In ancient Greece, marriage was largely about procreation and the controlled inheritance of property. It was treated as a kind of transaction in which fathers could present their daughters to prospective grooms as gifts, prizes, or rewards. Today, the practice of fathers symbolically or ceremonially giving away brides to their husbands echoes this conception of marriage. As Western European society changed, romantic love took over the institution of marriage. Contemporary weddings in Western Europe and North America usually come with a presumption that love brought the couple together, not a financial arrangement between men. Now, here's a way of interpreting this change. As a new social arrangement emerged in Western European culture, a new role gradually opened up, a place in social life for a kind of love distinctively related to marriage. A need had arisen for a kind of love that would bring couples together in a monogamous, lifelong, nuclear family-like bond, replacing the work previously done by patriarchal financial arrangements. Seen that way, a view of romantic love as defined by its role in this new social setup starts to make sense. It appeared because we had created certain specific work for it to do. Of course, various other kinds of love were around already. We're talking about how romantic love as we know it came to exist. The ancient Greeks had several words for different kinds of love, including eros, agape, and philia. Eros is often translated as passionate love or desire. Agape is usually taken to refer to a kind of brotherly love, interpreted in some Christian traditions as the love of God for us and vice versa. And philia is a kind of friendly affection. But romantic love isn't exactly any of these, although it can include components of each. Eros is perhaps the best contender, but romantic love need not always be passionate or erotic in the modern sense. And a pure sexual lust could count as a form of eros, but would not count as romantic love. The idea that romantic love is a social construct is part of a broader intellectual movement that pushes back against our temptation to attribute to biology things that are really the products of social institutions, practices, and traditions. This movement stretches across contemporary debates about the nature of gender, race, disability, orientation, and other things. A social constructionist about gender, for example, might say that gender is not a feature of a person's natural biological makeup. It is rather a matter of conforming or being expected to conform to certain norms around behavior, dress, self-presentation, social roles, and so on. Gender, in this constructionist picture, is created when we as a society decide to bundle together these norms and attach them to biological markers such as genitalia or chromosomes. While a gender may be assigned to a child at birth on a presumed biological basis, say based on the child's having male or female genitalia, the social constructionist maintains that gender itself is no part of the child's biology. This offers one possible explanation for how some trans people can be assigned a gender that does not match their gender identity. A social constructionist about romantic love may hold, correspondingly, that romantic love is a product of social expectations, traditions, and norms, rather than a biological phenomenon. Love might be associated with biological markers, once identifiable as fuzzy feelings of excitement or warmth, now traceable to the involvement of dopamine or oxytocin, but the constructionist says these biological markers are not what romantic love truly is. So what exactly is romantic love for a social constructionist? Well, it depends on which constructionist you ask. But just as Helen Fisher gave us a clear example of a biological theory, two psychologists, Anne Beal and Robert Sternberg, offer a clear example of a social constructionist theory. So let's take a look at what they think love is and why. It takes a village to fall in love. In 1995, Beal and Sternberg published a paper titled The Social Construction of Love. In this work, they say they find it difficult, if not impossible, to address the question of what romantic love is because any answer must reflect its time period and place, and in particular, the functions that romantic love serves there. In other words, whatever the biological theorists might say, there is no hope of a once-and-for-all answer. Love varies among cultures. And Beal and Sternberg don't just mean that it gets described or expressed differently. They mean the actual phenomenon, the experience of love itself, varies. Culture certainly affects how we express love, but that by itself would be no challenge to the idea that love's nature is biological. After all, culture also affects how we express hunger and pain. To give one example inspired by their discussion, consider a woman falling in love in Victorian England. The idea is that she will literally go through a different process compared to a woman falling in love in contemporary Canada. For the Victorian lady, falling in love is a matter of developing a deep and respectful, but probably rather distant, admiration for a man. Sexual desire is at best irrelevant to this process, at worst a shameful distraction. For the contemporary Canadian, however, falling in love is a matter of developing an intimate attachment that normatively includes sexual desire. If sexual desire is absent, that is at best noticeably unusual. At worst, it is interpreted as showing that the feelings involved are not romantic, but platonic. According to the constructionist theory, this is a difference in the actual phenomenon of romantic love, not just how it gets expressed. But notice that even variation in the phenomenon itself doesn't yet prove that love is a social construct. After all, two different cultural groups might vary with regard to how fast their fingernails grew, for genetic or environmental reasons. Rate of nail growth would still be a biological feature and not a socially constructed one. The key point is that genetics and environment don't offer any obvious explanation for the differences between Victorian love and contemporary love. While variation across cultures doesn't entail social constructionism, it provides evidence for it when the best or only explanation of that variation is that different societies are constructing different things. As Beal and Sternberg put it, there is not one particular reality that is simultaneously experienced by all people. When it comes to love, people are not passive recipients of a set of events, but are actively constructing social information. This is their constructionist conclusion. There is also the alternative of attributing mass error. We could say one culture has romantic love truly figured out and everyone else is getting it wrong, but I don't see any legitimate reason for privileging one culture's ideas about love in this way, taking them alone to track reality. In particular, I don't think biology gives us any reason to privilege one culture's ideas about love. I'll say more about this later. It is also significant that the kinds of variation love exhibits are major and quite central to the whole idea of what love is, indeed who we are. They do not reflect mere tinkering around the edges of a kind we could easily attribute to misunderstandings or differences of expression. Beal and Sternberg present a wealth of examples of large-scale cultural variation as evidence to support their constructionist view. We've already seen how romantic love was not always sexualized. Victorian culture commonly conceived of love as lofty, admirable, and asexual, while it viewed sex quite negatively. During the Enlightenment, romantic love was seen as rational, or at least potentially under rational control, while the Romantics saw it as uncontrollable and tumultuous. The treatment of love as the basis for marriage and family formation is a recent development in cultures of European origin. And some older work cited by Beal and Sternberg suggests that the kind of romantic love construed as normal in contemporary US culture would more likely seem aberrant from the perspective of Chinese culture. Beale and Sternberg diagnosed this last difference by contrasting what they perceive as American individualism, with its emphasis on emotional self-expression, with what they characterize as a Chinese cultural emphasis on family and social relations. It is worth bearing in mind, however, that they were writing in 1995 and citing research from the 1980s. Attitudes towards this kind of difference have become more sophisticated over time as researchers veer away from dealing in monolithic cultural stereotypes. Beale and Sternberg also explain how these differing social standards shape individual experiences. People regulate their own experiences of love and those of others around them by encouraging favored manifestations and discouraging others in accordance with the norms of their social setting. The resultant phenomenon is, in many ways, a far cry from anything hardwired in us by nature or biology. Society versus biology. Supposing love is indeed a social construct, what should we say about biology? Beale and Sternberg do not entirely deny its relevance, but they mention it only in passing. We can presume love includes a biological component, they say, and they quickly move on. I devoted the entire previous chapter to the biology of love because I think the place of biology in this story is too important and complicated to pass over quickly. In fact, many of the most important philosophical questions about love arise precisely at the interface between love's social construction and its biology. At a minimum, we must understand the biology of love to understand what belongs on the social side and what doesn't. But it's not surprising that biology typically fails to loom large in the thinking of social constructionists. When it comes to theorizing about the nature of a phenomenon, be it love or anything else, social constructionism is typically set in opposition to the biological approach. Consider a 1992 article by William Jankowiak and Edward Fisher titled A Cross-Cultural Perspective on Romantic Love. Jankowiak and Fisher point out that a majority of anthropologists and psychologists have previously assumed that romantic love is a social construct, but some evolutionary-oriented scientists, including Helen Fisher, whose work we discussed in Chapter 1, have started to ask whether it might be a human universal, centered on a biological core. This evolutionary perspective, they say, suggests that romantic love arises from forces within the hominid brain that are independent of the socially constructed mind. Jankowiak and Fisher then corral empirical evidence and analysis to make the case that romantic love is indeed a biological human universal and not a social construct. They analyze data from 166 cultures looking for evidence of the presence of romantic love. Although they failed to find such evidence in 19 of the cultures they studied, they believed that these negative cases resulted from ethnographic oversight. Because they found romantic love to be present in the remaining 147 cultures, they concluded that it can be muted but never entirely repressed by social factors. However, we should question what exactly they were measuring. They define romantic love as any intense attraction that involves the idealization of the other within an erotic context, with the expectation of enduring for some time into the future. This makes it sound a lot like they were measuring a form of sexual infatuation. As a baseline, romantic love surely has to be a kind of love. But the Jankowiak-Fisher definition doesn't seem to require this. Another pressing question is just what it would take for romantic love to be a human universal. Jankowiak and Fisher examined cultures for whether romantic love is present in them at all. But Beale and Sternberg were looking at the ways romantic love varies across cultures. Love might be universal in one sense but not the other. Even if it is always present, it could be substantially different in different cultures, and the latter kind of variation might still be evidence of social construction. Jankowiak and Fisher's results are nevertheless interesting and suggestive. They indicate that something in the broad vicinity of romantic attraction transcends even extremes of cultural difference. Biology may yet be a bigger part of the puzzle than a simple social constructionism can account for. By this point, the picture is starting to look deeply complex. The complexity seems to involve a clash between social constructionism and the biological approach. And yet there is clearly wisdom on both sides. This tangle requires careful unpicking. We can give up any hope of a quick fix or an answer we can sum up in a platitude. Once again, I find myself starting to wonder what is real here. What is real? Part 2. While Beale and Sternberg's constructionism may not be the whole story, they're clearly right about the social significance of romantic love in many cultures. This is closely tied to love's social function, its role in structuring a society by providing contours for how intimate loving relationships are supposed to be configured. It defines the tram lines, as it were, along which we expect our relationships and our lives to run. Beale and Sternberg put it this way: conceptions of love reflect cultural ideas about humanity. Think of how Enlightenment love was taken to be under rational control, whereas Romantic thinkers treated love as uncontrollable and tumultuous. This parallels a shift in the dominant understandings of human nature from fundamentally reasonable and rational, Enlightenment, to fundamentally passionate and untamed, Romantic. Different ways of socially constructing love implicitly define what is appropriate and desirable in human relations, as Beale and Sternberg say. For example, conceptions that they describe as Western, wherein romantic love is construed as a suitable basis for marriage, predominate in individualistic societies organized around a nuclear family structure. By contrast, they associate the prevalence of arranged marriages with extended family structure and collectivist social attitudes. As with Fisher's biological theory, I feel basically persuaded by the gist of Beale and Sternberg's social constructionism. But I am hesitant about it for two reasons. First, from a philosophical perspective, it can't be the whole story. Biology is part of the puzzle. And second, I want to spell out the details of love's social construction in my own way. Before I go into those details, though, let me highlight two common mistakes about social constructionism. These mistakes tend to crop up in discussions of the social construction of gender, race, and other things too, so they're well worth clearing up. Just keeping these two points in mind will put you ahead of the game in most conversations about social constructionism. The first mistake is to imagine that social constructs are a kind of fantasy or fiction. There is a temptation to say that anything socially constructed is made up and hence not real. A 2015 Globe and Mail column by Margaret Wente contains multiple examples of this slip in quick succession. Race and sex are more than social constructs, they are also facts, and you can't change the facts the way you change your shirt. Gender, for example, is no longer viewed as an inescapable biological fact, but is really an arbitrary product of our belief systems. Race, too, is often said to be a fiction, yet as a social construction, it is an awfully sturdy one. This sort of thing is common, but it is a serious error. Many social constructs are very real, and incidentally, many are far from arbitrary. Just think of business corporations, universities, laws, political parties, birthday parties, or the country where you live. All of these things are created by social institutions, practices, and traditions. But they obviously don't belong to the realm of fiction alongside Sherlock Holmes and unicorns. Laws are as much a part of real life as mountains and kittens. If we wrote two big lists of things that are real and things that aren't, Holmes and unicorns would go on the not real list, but laws would go with mountains and kittens on the real list. Socially constructed things are playing vital roles in your life right now. If you live in a country with a government, use a currency, work for a business, or are the legal guardian of a child. The second mistake is to imagine that social institutions, practices, or traditions that one finds abhorrent do not give rise to real social constructs. For example, if someone finds violence towards the innocent abhorrent, and on that basis decides that any law prescribing or condoning such violence is not a real law, that person is making this second kind of mistake. Laws are just as real when they are unethical or misguided. There was a very real law against male homosexuality in England in the 1950s. Among its very real effects was chemical castration, to which the famous logician and philosopher Alan Turing was subjected. Immoral laws shape people's lives, and it takes real work to dismantle them. If they weren't real laws, they wouldn't be such a problem. In an analogous way, a set of misguided social norms and traditions can give rise to a social construct of romantic love that needlessly and harmfully excludes same-sex love. This social construct is no less real on account of its being based in unethical practices. It still impacts people's lives, and it takes work to change a situation like this. So to sum up my two main points here, many social constructs are real, and some of them are really awful. If romantic love is indeed a social construct, that doesn't mean it isn't serious business or that it isn't seriously messed up. KISSING. Now for some of the details. Think how much information about love is packed into a playground rhyme. So-and-so and so-and-so sitting in a tree, KISSING. First comes love, then comes marriage, then comes baby in a baby carriage. This rhyme teaches children what love is by teaching them what love does. It ingrains in their minds the idea of romantic love as occupying a place between physical affection on the one hand and marriage plus reproduction on the other. It also presents love as something that involves two people, there are only spaces for two names in the rhyme, and is typically hetero. Usually one girl's name and one boy's name are used. My theory about love's nature is ultimately a version of the old adage that love is as love does. And this one cute rhyme conveys such a lot of information about what love does. Love, the rhyme tells us, takes as input two people of different genders who are physically affectionate, and it outputs a nuclear family. Love is a nexus connecting these important dots in social life. That is its function, its role. In a society that values romantic love as its primary model for a normal life, powerful feelings of care and desire that one experiences for another person will tend to be focused towards the creation of a marriage-based, monogamous, lifelong, reproductive family unit with that person. Once formed, that nuclear unit can be locked in by providing social and legal benefits such as tax breaks, social approbation, and hospital visiting rights that incentivize staying together, while making the alternatives, separation and divorce, costly and complicated. Romantic love has the function of structuring society into nuclear family units, harnessing the powerful forces of adult attraction, affection, and care to that end. It works so well that it becomes easy to forget that the default nuclear family is not the only way to structure social life. We could all live in larger communal groups, or we could all live much more isolated lives. Or we could treat a wide range of social configurations as normal, rather than seeing any one model as the default. But we don't. We literally romanticize romantic love, and in so doing, we hand it the power to structure society, to direct us into nuclear family units. That is the real power of love. But is this a good thing or a bad thing? Well, it can be either. Often it's both. To explain why, let me say a bit more about what I think love is. First, romantic love is a kind of love. That much seems clear, although it is in danger of getting overlooked in some of the research. So, what makes romantic love a kind of love? Well, it has the features that any kind of love would have. It involves care, concern, trust, openness, and tenderness, for example. I'm not saying these things are social constructs, nor am I saying that all kinds of love are socially constructed. Social construction, in my view, comes into play in separating out certain kinds of love as romantic. Romantic love's distinctive social function sets it apart from all other kinds of love. This function is of the essence for understanding romantic love's social nature. Other kinds of love, such as the kind of love involved in a close friendship, do not have the same function. It is normally accepted that one may have as many friends as one cares to have, and there is no expectation that one will live with one's friends or have their children. If we do start experiencing very powerful feelings of care or desire for a friend, we are pressured to interpret this as falling in romantic love. Of course, love's function doesn't always work out. Love may go unrequited, face insuperable practical obstacles, fizzle, and so on. Love can fail to generate stable nuclear family units in all sorts of ways. But the very fact that these things get counted as failures goes to show what love is supposed to do. And although love's function is important, that doesn't mean it's possible to count someone who just goes through the motions as being in love. That is, if they do all the kissing, marriage, nuclear family formation, reproduction, and so on, while feeling nothing. As I said up front, romantic love is a kind of love. Its distinctive social role is what makes it romantic, not what makes it love. Love isn't compatible with going through the motions and feeling nothing. And although it's not my main focus in this chapter, I do want to keep in mind that in addition to its social nature, romantic love has a biological profile that can help explain why it is associated with powerful feelings. I'll come back to this issue. I also don't mean to suggest that the social function of romantic love is unchanging or inevitable. On the contrary, social structures change, and the functional role of romantic love changes along with them. I'm trying to capture what romantic love is, that is, what it does, around me, here and now. Supposing all this is on the right track, one of the most important consequences is that there is space for questioning and critiquing romantic love, and specifically its role in structuring society. If we thought of romantic love as a universal, natural, biological phenomenon, then social critique would seem unproductive and inappropriate. We could bemoan the social consequences of headaches, but to cure them, we need medicine, not marches. But once we start to see how we are responsible for romantic love's social contours, how we create and sustain them through the cultural norms we accept and reinforce, everything changes. This way of understanding what love is suddenly throws open a whole range of possibilities for what love could be. But what now has happened to the original case for thinking of love as biological? By this point, it may be starting to look like things have gotten seriously tangled, and sooner or later we are going to have to choose. We'll either have to say romantic love is hardwired into our biology, a bundle of neurochemical responses that we've evolved to exhibit under certain circumstances, or that it is a social construct with a particular function in organizing society. Surely it can't be both. Our evolved neurochemistry is not a social construct. What gives? I believe we can answer that question in a philosophically satisfying way. But before I explain how, I want to take a sidestep through some of the philosophical background. Philosophy has consistently both inspired and disappointed me in my efforts to understand love. So to put my work in context, let me take you on a whistle-stop tour through some of what philosophers have had to say about love over the years and where that leaves a philosopher of love these days. Chapter 3. Gems at the Garage Sale. Philosophers on Love. And yet, to say the truth, reason and love keep little company together nowadays. The more the pity that some honest neighbors will not make them friends. William Shakespeare, A Midsummer Night's Dream. Unlike many other philosophers. When I first started studying what philosophers had to say about love, I have to admit I was disappointed. At its best, philosophical inquiry can be creative, original, exciting, and unsettling. It can reveal our hidden assumptions, forcing us to look them in the face and assess them for what they are worth. In real life, though, no discipline is perfect, and not everything done under the banner of philosophy is all that. Some of it is a frankly embarrassing catalogue of pompous people tripping over their own assumptions. Sadly, the philosophy of love is no exception. but philosophy has inspired me too, so I want to start with some of the inspirations. Bertrand Russell is one philosopher who's inspired and influenced me in multiple ways. If you studied philosophy at university and came across Russell in that context, you might know him for his theory of definite descriptions, which tries to explain the inner logical workings of sentences that seem to be about non-existent objects, like "the present king of France is bald." Fascinating though this is, Russell's thinking about love and marriage had a far bigger impact on the world than his thinking about logic and language. Russell won a Nobel Prize for Literature in 1950 on the strengths of his books for A Public of Laymen, which, according to the award ceremony speech, contain a good deal of material that excites protest, and precisely this sets Russell apart. Unlike many other philosophers, Russell regards this as one of the natural and urgent tasks of an author. One of his protested books was Marriage and Morals. First published in 1929, this book now reads as considerably ahead of its time. Russell was a precursor of the contemporary sex-positive movement. He utterly rejected the idea that sex was shameful, sinful, or dirty. He called the repressive sexual mores of his own era a morbid aberration, comparable to the prohibition of alcohol in the United States, i.e., producing outcomes of a lower quality, but making them seem a lot more exciting than they really were. He thought we should be less prudish about pornography, scolded men for failing to make sex enjoyable for their female partners, helped campaign for the decriminalization of male homosexuality in the United Kingdom, and denounced the blazing injustice of treating sex workers with no respect. He stressed the importance of providing comprehensive information about sex, including birth control and sexual health, to young people. Perhaps most famously of all, he advocated for what in his time was known as free love, foreshadowing contemporary notions of open and monogamous relationships. Is Russell starting to sound a bit like Dan Savage to you? If so, that is a pretty fair comparison. But to give this some context, Russell published Marriage and Morals 35 years before Savage was even born. Still, Russell had what, in contemporary terms, we would call a huge platform from which he could disseminate his progressive opinions widely, even when they utterly contravened prevailing social norms. Just as Dan Savage's platform rests on the success of a hugely popular advice column and podcast, Russell's sprang from his own prior achievements, albeit of a different kind. He traded on his outstanding early work in logic and the philosophy of mathematics, his scholarly reputation, and his affiliations with the University of Cambridge and the Royal Society. It's worth bearing in mind, too, that Russell's social class bolstered his ability to speak out on controversial topics. As a member of the British aristocracy, he was more audible than most of his contemporaries and better shielded from the consequences of voicing his views. Yet even with these advantages, Russell ran into serious trouble for thinking and speaking freely, eventually losing an academic job after scandalizing the world, or at least social conservatives in the United States, with his attitudes towards love and sex. His work on these topics never secured a place in the established canon of academic philosophy, despite its impact on the world at large. Bootleg Russell. Although love mattered deeply to Russell, over the years, the very tradition of philosophy that he helped to launch has largely shied away from his style of publicly engaged critical thinking about things like love, sex, and relationships. As a student of philosophy at Cambridge, I was thoroughly put through my paces on Russell's philosophy of logic and language, and as a graduate student, I delved into his philosophy of mathematics. But his views on love, marriage, and sex were never on the syllabus. Naturally, this just makes them even more intriguing. Russell was not wrong about the psychological impact of attempts to keep something off people's radar. Discovering Marriage and Morals felt like discovering bootleg Russell, intoxicating if a bit dodgy. I was fascinated to read this work in which Russell is so compellingly at once both a philosopher and a human being. It's not by chance that this book didn't make it onto my syllabus. Russell himself said that his work on love and other socio-political subjects was a separate business from his philosophy. This distinction both reflected and reinforced conservative conceptions of what belongs in the academy. But whatever his classifications, Russell clearly considered his capacities for open-minded critical thinking relevant to the topic of love. And whatever he thought philosophy was, philosophy actually has a venerable tradition of engaged, sometimes unsettling, critical thought on hot socio-political topics, love included. Plato's Republic and Symposium are about how the state should operate and how people should practice love, and these works are at least as political and polemical as anything Russell ever wrote. Socrates was put to death for corrupting the youth with his unsettling conversations and for his impiety in questioning things one wasn't supposed to question. This kind of work has always been part of philosophy's remit. 20th century efforts to redefine philosophy as a pure, logico-scientific and apolitical pursuit were a temporary blip and ultimately a failure. My generation of philosophers is now coming to understand that academic philosophy was never apolitical, although pretending it was often led to a dangerous lack of awareness. In any case, what Russell did in his philosophical work on love, as opposed to how he labeled it, is a source of inspiration to me. It was influential in my decision to write this audiobook. But inspiration is complicated, and I don't want to give the impression that Russell is my hero. He also expounded racist beliefs and displayed grossly dehumanizing attitudes towards disability. Despite the book's title, in Marriage and Morals, romantic love is really the star of the show. Russell thought that sex should be treated as experimentation with a view to love, and that marriage should be about the legal recognition and regulation of relationships based on love, its main purpose being to ensure the proper long-term care of the biological children born into loving hetero relationships. Note how, once again, romantic love is presented as playing a distinctive functional role in society. For Russell, love is a nexus linking sexual experimentation on the one hand with stable reproductive nuclear family units on the other. We find in Russell more or less the same theory of love that the K-I-S-S-I-N-G rhyme conveys to children on the playground. Russell's radical addition was that a love-based marriage need not be sexually or romantically monogamous. He proposed open marriages as an alternative, making the case that it is better to rein in jealousy than to rein in love. However, unlike his contemporary counterpart Dan Savage, who acknowledges that monogamy works for some while non-monogamy works for others, Russell seemed to be proposing open marriage as the new norm for everyone. So, what did Russell think was so bad about monogamy? The answer lies in how he thought monogamous romantic love was connected to gender and power. He diagnosed the addition of monogamy into the social role of love and marriage as emanating from men's desire to secure reproductive control over women in order to create and maintain a patriarchal family-based social order with property inheritance passing down the male line. The idea of imposing sexual monogamy as a restriction on men, as Russell notes, is a more recent development. Russell ultimately attributes patriarchy itself, with its attendant physical and mental subjection of women, to the discovery of how biological paternity works. He also emphasizes the role of religion in enforcing patriarchy, monogamy, and women's oppression, particularly Christianity, which Russell identifies as elevating fatherhood to a position of supreme importance. As a consequence of all this, Russell says, it came to be seen as ideal for women to lack sexual desire altogether, since this made it much easier to control their reproductive potential. But this kind of situation could be sustained only if women were continually oppressed. Moreover, Russell regarded the imposition of monogamy on both sexes as a leveling down, not a solution. If we may judge by appearances, he says, women will tend to prefer a system allowing freedom to both sexes than one imposing upon men the restrictions which hitherto have been suffered only by women. Russell doesn't say exactly what appearances he is judging by here, but I assume he based this statement on his own experiences of interacting with women. In a similar vein, Russell wanted us to know that women whose sexual life is uninhibited are as liable as men to sexual impulses, as far as he had been able to observe. What do we want? 85 years on, these anecdotal hypotheses of Russell's are finally being taken seriously enough to be scientifically tested. The results are starting to make a cultural impact, evinced in the recent success of popular books like Christopher Ryan and Casilda Jatar's Sex at Dawn and Daniel Bergner's What Do Women Want? To give an example, new empirical research by psychologists Andreas Baranowski and Heiko Hecht challenges the received wisdom that women don't want casual sex. Back in the 1970s and 1980s, psychologists conducted a study in which an opposite-sex partner offered college students casual sex. All of the women declined, whereas 3/4 of the men accepted. This could be interpreted as evidence that women are biologically driven to guard their eggs and virtue vigilantly and to tolerate sex only in return for marriage or money. At least, that is an easy conclusion to jump to under the influence of social messaging that hammers this idea home every day. But it's also possible that the women were scared. Scared of social stigmatization or for their physical safety. In a famous passage published in 1982, Margaret Atwood explains how when she asked a male friend why men feel threatened by women, he said, "They're afraid women will laugh at them, undercut their worldview." But when she asked some of her women students why women feel threatened by men, they told her, "They're afraid of being killed." In their study, Baranowski and Hecht reproduced the finding that women reject casual sex with an opposite-sex partner when propositioned in ordinary social situations. But they took their research a step further, testing what would happen if subjects received the same offer in an environment where they believed they would be safe from physical harm and social stigma. In this study, the huge gender disparity vanished. Women picked on average about 3 out of 10 men they thought were available for casual sex, whereas men picked on average about 4 out of 10 women. 29 of the 30 women in the study said that they would like to have sex with at least one of the men on offer. Recent studies also raise complex questions about whether women are biologically hardwired to prefer sexual monogamy. For example, psychologists Meredith Chivers and Amanda Timmers conducted research that found women to be genitally aroused by erotic stories about encounters with strangers, as well as with long-term partners. Bertrand Russell may have foreshadowed some of these findings, but philosophizing about what women, or for that matter men, want in the absence of empirical data is a risky business. That said, this risky business has been going on for a long time. Back in 1884, political philosopher Friedrich Engels published The Origins of the Family, Private Property and the State, in which he hypothesized that monogamy would arise naturally if only love, sex, and marriage could be separated from concerns about property and inheritance, because women and men would want monogamy under ideal conditions. He claimed that sex love is by its nature exclusive, although he noted that in his time, only women had realized this exclusivity. And so he predicted, remove the economic considerations that now force women to submit to the customary disloyalty of men, and you will place women on an equal footing with men. All present experiences prove that this will tend much more strongly to make men truly monogamous than to make women polyandrous. It's unclear exactly what counts as all present experiences here, although presumably Engels' own experiences are included. Engels beat Russell to the idea that bourgeois monogamous marriage was designed to assure men of paternity and secure the inheritance of property by their biological male offspring. Engels added that its other role was to ensure that women provided men with unpaid domestic labor. But on the question of what women want, these two men had very different ideas, though both reported basing their ideas on experience. But what if Russell and Engels were both wrong? What if there is no single model of what women or men want? What if some of us naturally want monogamy and others don't? Perhaps Russell and Engels simply knew different people, and that's why experience delivered such different verdicts to them. I'm just going to leave that idea there for now, but it will be important later. While Russell was ahead of his time in some ways, in other ways, he failed to see where things were heading. What, against the backdrop of 1920s Britain, must have sounded like a radical free love manifesto, was not really as free or as radical as it might have been. While he recognized that there was nothing morally wrong with sex between two men, he still thought of romantic love, marriage, and child-rearing as limited to hetero couples. In fact, he found this so obvious as to require no comment. Russell was radical for his time in defending the idea that premarital sex should be acceptable for women as well as for men, and that marriage should not require sexual exclusivity. But for all he may have been sex-positive by Victorian standards, he still thought sex without love was of little value. And he still ultimately presented extramarital sex and love as inevitable and forgivable, rather than as things people might actively choose and prefer for their own sake. It must be love. I'm disturbed by, but haven't yet mentioned, another feature of Russell's philosophy of love. This one relates to a deep-seated assumption that is still widely shared, which means it's a bit trickier to bring to the surface. So I'm going to approach it in a roundabout way via what philosophers call the union view of romantic love. The union view says that romantic love consists in union with another person and/or desire for such union. You might recall that Robert Nozick put forward a version of this view. Now, Russell himself doesn't explicitly say union is the defining characteristic of love, but he certainly thinks it is one of love's important features. He writes that love breaks down the hard walls of the ego, producing a new being composed of two in one. He acknowledges the fear of losing one's own individuality in the process of becoming part of a new being, but he calls this fear foolish, since individuality is not an end in itself, and the loss of separateness is actually required for a satisfying life. Love, for Russell, is the best thing that life has to give. This sentiment might sound sweet, even cute, but it's not. A word recently coined by philosopher Elizabeth Brake describes Russell's attitude here. Amato normativity. This coinage derives from the Latin words amare, to love, and norma, a standard against which things are measured. Amato normativity says that romantic love is the normal or ideal condition for a human life, so lives that don't include it are imperfect or abnormal. Russell's amato-normative attitude becomes especially pronounced when he says that those who haven't experienced mutual sexual love cannot attain their full stature and cannot feel towards the rest of the world that kind of generous warmth without which their social activities are pretty sure to be harmful. He says the resulting disappointment inclines them towards envy, oppression, and cruelty. This is a horrible and untrue thing to say. Many well-adjusted, happy, productive, and socially valuable people are single and haven't been in love, some by choice, others as it happens. Some of them are parents, some care for relatives or friends, most are ordinary people going about their business. It's outrageous to write them all off as disappointed, envious, failing to attain their full stature, and harmful to society. But this is the consequence of assuming that romantic love is required for a satisfying life. Like I said, not sweet and not cute. Russell's amato-normativity gets even more alarming when you appreciate that it encompasses his heteronormativity too. When he calls love the most fructifying of all human experiences, he means what he elsewhere calls serious love between a man and a woman. In a similar spirit, he also denigrates the childless, saying sex relations which are serious cannot develop their best potential without children and a common life. This dig hits me personally, as I have no kids and no current plans to acquire any. Russell held dismissive and belittling attitudes towards various deviations from what he regarded as the norm. While he was busy arguing for greater acceptance of his own particular deviations, he might have done a better job of noticing how he was recycling and reinforcing the exclusion of those who deviate in other ways. Heroes and humans. But I already said that Russell doesn't belong on a pedestal. Nor does any philosopher, or indeed any human. Nevertheless, it's a sad fact that philosophy sometimes fosters a culture of hero worship around certain figures whose pronouncements, however awful, unoriginal, or just plain boring, come to be treated as important by default. This is deleterious to great philosophy. Unfortunately, the philosophy of love is an arena in which this problem has really shown its true colors over the centuries. Its effects are bolstered and concealed by the pretense that philosophy is a purely apolitical and rational pursuit, in which approbation and canonization are accorded purely on the basis of merit, not status, class, gender, race, or anything else. In fact, philosophy has a long history of treating the ideas of men as a gender setting, according women's work a secondary place, or no place at all, in its canon. Let me tell you about a recent book titled Love, a History by philosopher Simon May. In this book, May traces two millennia of Western thought, as the cover promises. It's an impressive book, from which there is much to be learned. But here's the thing. Love, a History includes 10 chapters that focus on specific named thinkers. Most of these chapters are about one person, though a couple are about two. So all in all, 12 people get the honor of appearing in a chapter title. And without exception, all 12 are white men. They are in fact a selection of what we might call the usual suspects. Plato, Aristotle, Lucretius, Ovid, Spinoza, Rousseau, Schlegel, Novalis, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, Freud, and Proust. When the dust jacket advertises the book as an exploration of the very diverse philosophers and writers who have dared to think differently about love, it prompts one to wonder what counts as diversity in philosophy. Women thinkers do not get chapters of their own in May's Love, a History, but women appear as a topic of discussion. There is a chapter titled Women as Ideals, and there is an index entry for women, which includes sub-entries like as intellectual beings and as temptresses. There is no index entry for men, and to my knowledge, it has not often been up for discussion whether men are intellectual beings or tempters. May's book reflects a pattern that it did not create, but does help sustain. Understanding that pattern is important for understanding the history of the philosophy of love. If we interpret it incautiously, we risk coming away with the impression that the philosophy of love is done about women rather than by them. It is hard to know exactly what has been responsible for the devaluation and exclusion of women's voices in philosophy, though it is almost certainly a mix of factors. Recent research suggests this stems in part from an ingrained association between genius or brilliance and maleness. This association may not be deliberate or conscious, but if you ask people just to close their eyes and picture a genius, they're liable to picture an Einstein, a Darwin, or a Da Vinci. If, at some level, we associate being a great philosopher with being a genius, and we also associate being a genius with being a white man, it is not surprising if women somehow just don't seem to strike us as great philosophers. I also wonder if the image of analytic philosophy in particular as a male activity may have had something to do with what Russell, a founder of the analytic tradition, chose to classify as philosophy among his own writings. Is it a coincidence that he categorized Marriage and Morals, which discusses stereotypical women's business like love, marriage, family, and gender, as not being philosophy, reserving that label for his work on stereotypical men's business like logic, mathematics, and the mind? Even now, some regard books like Marriage and Morals as off-limits for real philosophy. In my opinion, philosophy is not so limited. Only its practitioners are. Philosophy itself has a lot of unrealized potential in this domain. Laurels and face palms. The situation I'm describing has impacted our collective philosophical conversations. To see how, let's take a brief tour through some murky corners of the canonical philosophy of love. In The Gay Science, Friedrich Nietzsche says that he will never admit that we should speak of equal rights in the love of man and woman. There are no such equal rights. He backs this up with the old chestnut that love is not the same for men as for women. What woman understands by love is clear enough, complete surrender, not merely devotion, of soul and body, without any motive, without any reservation. Her love is precisely a faith. Woman has no other. He adds that a woman wants to be taken and accepted as a possession, and draws a fairly explicit analogy between the perfect woman in love and a slave. By contrast, Nietzsche thinks that when a man is in love, he wants devotion and surrender from a woman. This may all sound strange and horrifying, but it fits neatly into Nietzsche's broader thought. In Beyond Good and Evil, he speaks of woman's incomprehensibility and opines that her nature is more natural than man's. These stereotypes are part of what Betty Friedan would later identify as the feminine mystique. He also provides a long list of women's causes for shame and rants that her great art is falsehood, her chief concern is appearance and beauty. While reading such misogynistic statements from a philosopher who is still canonized today can be shocking, it is perhaps more comprehensible when one bears in mind that decisions about what belongs in philosophy's canon have proceeded hand in hand with the perception of philosophy as a primarily male enterprise. With a sense of how Nietzsche views women and men, we can also look to his definition of love in another work, Ecce Homo. Love, in its means, is war. In its foundation, it is the mortal hatred of the sexes. This is an ancient cliché, and I mean ancient quite literally. The Roman poet Ovid discussed the same ideas nearly 2,000 years earlier. Today, they survive on the websites of men's rights activists. The idea that love is a sex war is not even the most bizarre claim about love in Ecce Homo. One contender for that title is Nietzsche's assertion that women all love him, except for the infertile ones. If we stumbled upon these sentiments published unattributed on a random website, we would hardly take them for the thoughts of a great philosopher. Like many canonized heroes, Nietzsche has apologists who will argue that he didn't mean what he appears to be saying in his misogynistic passages. Some say that he was really a feminist. If so, he was a feminist who was not very good at explaining feminism. He attributed calls for women's emancipation to the fact that defective, i.e. infertile, women hated other women who had turned out well, i.e. reproduced. But perhaps we mustn't take these things out of context? Perhaps they're ironic? One constantly hears such excuses for misogyny. There's another possibility, though. Nietzsche thought he had figured out a way to send different audiences the different messages they wanted to receive. He might have been trying to invent the two-tone political dog whistle. Psst, feminists, it's ironic, of course. Psst, misogynists, finally someone is brave enough to tell it like it is. But if such ambiguity is supposed to feed us what we want to hear, it leaves me completely unsatisfied. The philosophical tradition in which I was trained values clear and careful expression because in its absence one risks being seriously misinterpreted. And even before I knew there was such a thing as philosophy, I learned from my mother, who learned it from her grandmother, that there comes a point when you have to say what you mean and mean what you say. Another canonized philosopher, Arthur Schopenhauer, wrote in The World as Will and Representation, that however lofty or ethereal we might think it, love is really just a more definitely determined, specialized, and individualized sexual impulse. In particular, it is a heterosexual impulse, merely a question of every Hans finding his Greta. True to stereotype, only Hans has agency in the search process. Greta, we must suppose, waits patiently to be found. Schopenhauer, like Nietzsche, sees himself puncturing a grand illusion. But he too is just recycling stereotypes, including this one. By nature, man is inclined to inconstancy in love. woman to constancy, for nature moves her, instinctively and without reflection, to retain the nourisher and protector of the future offspring. Conveniently, this means that faithfulness in marriage is with the man artificial, with the woman it is natural, and thus adultery on the part of the woman is much less pardonable than on the part of the man. These assumptions about what is natural for women and men presage contemporary discussions about what we're biologically designed to do. In particular, Schopenhauer's emphasis on humanity's impulse and instinct for reproduction, a drive, so to speak, foreshadows the contemporary metaphysics of love put forward by Helen Fisher. In many respects, Schopenhauer was only a mouthpiece for social norms that long predated him and have long outlived him. His sexism is uncritical, and so is his heteronormativity. The problem is that Nietzsche and Schopenhauer are A-list philosophers, celebrities of the philosophy world, considered geniuses. Their thinking has shaped perceptions of romantic love, human nature, women, and philosophy itself. Nietzsche and Schopenhauer each get a chapter of their own in Love, a History. Both, like Russell, were the beneficiaries of multiple forms of social privilege. They were white, male, and middle or upper class. But in a sense, this put them in a position of philosophical disadvantage. One's privilege can make it harder to get critical insights into the things affected by that privilege, for the simple reason that the workings of privilege are usually far easier to notice and understand when you are not their beneficiary. Beneficiaries of privilege often are not even aware of its existence. They have never needed to be. To compound this problem, it can be deeply uncomfortable to regard one's favorable position within a social structure as due to privilege rather than solely one's own merits and efforts. So the beneficiaries of privilege can be strongly motivated to ignore it. If you are trying to figure out how romantic love works at a time when it is intimately bound up with sexism, heteronormativity, and other systematic oppressions, privilege is a philosophical hindrance. The upshot of all this is that in order to do great philosophy of love these days, we need to turn to more sources than just philosophy's canon. And within philosophy, we need to look beyond just the usual suspects. We need to clear a path through the tired old tropes that have been blasted on repeat for so long to seek out some of the more interesting, less trumpeted voices. A sense of what matters. It's not all Nietzsche's and Schopenhauer's in the history of the philosophy of love. Simone de Beauvoir addressed romantic love as part of a wide-ranging philosophical investigation of gender, and she developed conceptual resources for understanding both love and gender that are of importance for philosophy today, up to and including this audiobook. In her best-known work, The Second Sex, de Beauvoir was among the first to develop the idea of gender as a social construct, which she summarized in her famous statement that one is not born, but rather becomes woman. She identified various traits that we associate with womanhood, fragility, unintelligence, and unsuitability for leadership, for example. And she discussed the treatment of women as other, that is, defined by their relationships to men or what differentiates them from men, rather than as full subjects in their own right. Then she made the case that having particular genitalia at birth does not naturally or biologically determine such things. Instead, they are imposed by the society around us as we grow up. For instance, if boys' education is taken much more seriously than girls, it is not surprising if women then strike us as being less intelligent. This echoes a theme in earlier work by pioneering philosopher of gender Mary Wollstonecraft. De Beauvoir's views on romantic love are not rose-tinted. In The Woman in Love, a chapter of The Second Sex, she points out that Nietzsche's description of what love is like for women is actually not far off the mark when considered critically as a description of love in a deeply problematic society rather than the natural order. Romantic love, as de Beauvoir sees it, is damaging and dangerous to both women and men. It encourages women to seek their own annihilation through absorption into a man's life and identity. Otherwise, they risk being seen as unwomanly. But this is devastating to all the things that de Beauvoir, as an existentialist, considers necessary for an authentic life, in particular, the freedom to choose one's own path. Moreover, women in romantic love are taught to see their male partners as impossibly idealized, since otherwise their own annihilation would be too obviously irrational. But no man is impossibly ideal. The inevitable failure to live up to the prescribed manly role in patriarchal romantic love thus ultimately makes love deeply damaging for men as well. However, de Beauvoir includes one note of optimism. She says that one day, when women and men can approach each other as equals, love will become a source of life rather than mortal peril. Philosophers have put the idea of social construction to work in considering many topics besides gender. For example, Lucius Outlaw, Charles Mills, and others have argued that race is a social construct. In this audiobook, when I discuss romantic love as a social construct, I owe much to the philosophers who developed and refined this conceptual resource for me to work with. We can also find fascinating and sometimes even stereotype-defying work on the philosophy of love in much older texts. Plato put love of various kinds at the center of his philosophy, and intriguingly, he put a woman philosopher of love at the center of his most famous work on the topic, the Symposium. He has the character of Socrates credit a priestess called Diotima, possibly a fictionalized version of someone Plato knew, as the source for the most serious and original theory of love that appears in the work. Diotima's theory of love is complicated and strange to modern ears, but one of its interesting features is the idea that all humans are pregnant either in body or in soul, and love brings forth their offspring, be it children, art, or philosophy. Back in the present, philosophers are still at work figuring out what love is. In her recent book on romantic love, philosopher Berit Brogard has defended the view that romantic love is a kind of emotion. This classic philosophical view of love faces many challenges, including Fischer's argument that love is a drive. Brogard develops a version in which the emotion of romantic love can be either rational or irrational, which she thinks is important because rational love leads to happiness, but irrational love does not. Several other contemporary philosophers of love are also interested in the rationality and reasonableness of love, and I find this trend interesting. Psychologists Anne Beale and Robert Sternberg can help us contextualize it. Remember their discussion of how the Enlightenment view of human nature as fundamentally rational corresponds to the idea that love is ideally rational too. The current tendency among philosophers of love to focus on love's rationality and reasons makes me wonder if there is some Enlightenment-like conception of human nature at work behind the scenes in philosophy today. As for me, when considering the relationship between rationality and love, I'm drawn to something Bertrand Russell once said in a television interview. He was asked what messages he would want to send to future generations, and one of the two he picked was, "Love is wise, hatred is foolish." I think his choice of words here is significant. He didn't say love was rational or reasonable. He said it was wise. Why might that have been? Well, we can step back here and think about the word philosophy, which originally derives from a Greek word for love. The prefix philo is related to philia, meaning friendly affection, and a Greek word for wisdom, sophia. I have found it helps to keep this definition in mind when navigating contemporary analytic philosophy, which typically puts rationality and reason, not wisdom, center stage. This phenomenon stretches beyond the philosophy of love and has been bound up with analytic philosophy's self-conception as a logical, scientific, and apolitical enterprise. I am a fan of rationality and reason, and I think they can be elements of wisdom, but I don't think they are all of it. Insightfulness can also be an important part of wisdom. So can creativity, originality, and a quality that's often overlooked, a sense of what matters. This last is particularly important for thinking about love when everyone has something to say, and one of the biggest challenges is curating a path through the mass of information and opinions. I certainly think there is a place for questions about individual rationality and reasonableness when it comes to understanding love. But, inspired by Beal and Sternberg, de Beauvoir, and others, I also think it is important to keep a bigger societal picture in view. Let me finish up with a recap of two morals from this chapter. First, philosophers are not immune to making awful pronouncements about anything and everything, love included. Just like the biology of love, the psychology of love, the sociology of love, and every other ongoing cultural conversation about love, the philosophy of love is often a messy bundle of uncritical assumptions and flashes of insight. I see myself rummaging around in it like a pile of clothes at a garage sale. I've found some gems in there, but also a lot of stuff I have no use for. And even with the gems, Bertrand Russell especially, I feel like I'd need to take them home and give them a good wash before I'd be comfortable wearing them. Philosophy has powerful tools to offer anyone who wants to better understand the nature of love, but proceed with caution when reading what philosophers have to say about it. This applies equally to the audiobook you are listening to right now. The second moral is that while I've found interesting gems, I have not found what I'm looking for. My own sense of what matters keeps insisting that the most urgent task facing a philosopher of love right now is to find a satisfying resolution to this audiobook's central dilemma. How can love be both biological and a social construct? That work is still waiting. It's time to turn to it in earnest.